Hi, you're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve Ornstein, and today we have a special guest, a great interview. It's Professor Charles Blatberg from University of Montreal, professor of political philosophy. Just a little bio, brief. Blatberg grew up in Toronto. He studied towards his undergraduate degree at the University of Toronto. In 89, he was elected to serve and represent the university's over 30,000 undergraduates as president of its Student Administrative Council. Between 90 and 92, he attended McGill University, where he received his MA studying under the philosopher Charles Taylor. He then went to England and France. He's been busy. And was awarded a DEA from the Sorbonne, University of Paris, in 1996, and his doctorate the following year at the University of Oxford, where he did his research under professors Michael Frieden and Sir Isaiah Berlin. This was followed by 2 years of postdoctoral research at Hebrew University of Jerusalem and Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, and 1 year as an assistant professor of political philosophy at Tel Aviv University, and he's been teaching political philosophy at the University of Montreal since 2000. He's currently a Lady Davis Visiting Professor at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. So, welcome.
Well, thank you. Well, that's quite an intro.
Well, you deserve it. Also, I know that you've written a number of books. I just mention them for those who may be interested. From Pluralist to Patriotic Politics, it was put out by the Oxford University Press 2000. Shall We Dance? A Patriotic Politics for Canada. Also, McGill Queen's University Press, 2003. You have a forthcoming book, Patriotic Elaboration, Essays in Practical Philosophy.
That's it, yep.
Wow. And, of course, because I have to mention this one, a novel, The Adventurous Young Philosopher, Theo Hoshin of Toronto.
Right, but Theo, he's not with us yet. We're only about halfway through.
Ah,
so I have
okay.
to wait for that.
I can't wait. So what are you up to here, besides being a Lady Davis Visiting Professor?
Well, as you know, Steve, I'm also studying Hebrew, because that's where we met. Right?
Yes.
In the Ulpan Gordon. So every morning, right at 9.
It starts at 8:50.
I
show
up.
Not setting a good example for you.
No, I have to say, it's a bit weird being on the other side of the classroom again, but it's good. It's good. It brings back old memories and so on. So yeah, so I'm there with you, and we're studying away. Trying to ki tibet, right?
Ki tibet.
Or gimel, or we're sort of in
between. We're a high bet.
Yeah, it's a high bet.
A high bet.
It's moving quick.
Serious, 5 days a week, what, 5 hours a day?
Yeah, it's pretty intense.
It's very intense.
But yeah, there's progress, I would say.
Yeah, we have our break at 10 o'clock,
right.
Which we desperately need, and it's only a half hour. It's way too short. So what else is going on? What else are you doing? I mean, you've been here now for almost a year, is that right?
Yep, yep. Well, this is basically my sabbatical year. I've been here since, I guess, August, and we'll be going back in just a few weeks.
And you're married
to right.
an Israeli, Yael?
Yep, Yael. One of the deals when we hitched up was that every sabbatical we'd come back here, so... Here we are.
I think she's looking forward to you coming here on a more full-time basis.
Well, she's definitely at home here.
I mean, I would love you to be here all the time.
Yeah. Well, I also, of course, feel quite a draw here. You know, this is a very special place. So whenever we get a chance, we'll be back.
So what do you think of the current situation here, being a philosopher and being involved in politics from an academic point of view?
Well, politically, domestically, I can't really say very much because, as usual, I'm just, I think like many people, I'm just confused. It's quite a chaotic place, politics-wise. In terms of the international situation, particularly the Arab-Israeli conflict, there hasn't actually been that much in the way of change, I think, for quite some time. So,
Hamas now heading the government is a pretty serious change.
On one level, certainly. But in another, you know, many people say, and I have to admit that I go along with this, that in a sense we're just getting a clear sense of what they are on about. Hamas is just a little more upfront about their positions than some previous governments. And in that sense, there hasn't been that much in the way of change. That said, I one of the things I was thinking we might talk about today would be what I think about the Arab-Israeli conflict and where we should be going with it and how we should be responding to it.
It's all yours.
Okay. I should say that my thinking about it is somewhat connected to my more abstract thinking, the level of political philosophy. And my philosophical work really focuses quite a bit on the notion of dialogue, of what it means to say that when we're engaged in politics, what we're doing is responding to conflict with dialogue. Well, what is dialogue, and are there different kinds, and what does it entail to invoke them and to be involved in them? And in particular, one distinction which I think is extremely important is that between a form of dialogue which I call conversation and another one which is well known, negotiation. Now, obviously here, one of the major responses to the conflict has been to attempt to negotiate between Israelis and the Palestinians, and many see the Oslo process as, in a sense, encapsulating that response. And of course, it seems like that didn't go very far in the end. And so as a result, we have turned either to very sort of overt senses of force, or what's now called the disengagement or the withdrawal plan, which is, in a way, another form of force, obviously less extreme than simply using the army. But it's unilateral, and so it's not a form of dialogue, right? One thing we know about dialogue is that it's got to involve at least
two people,
or it's at least got to go in two directions. And if you're invoking a policy that's unilateral, well, that's one direction.
Right.
So given that, the question is, what is that, for me at least, is that the right way to go? And I have to say, my answer is no. I think that actually the route we're taking now, and when I say we, I should sort of right up front say that I'm speaking as a Zionist. A Zionist who, as you're about to hear, is not necessarily within the mainstream of the ideology, but nevertheless, I identify myself as a Zionist.
So explain to me what premature unilateral disengagement is. In other words, are we referring to the fact that we're just unilaterally disengaging in terms of putting up the wall and or fence or whatever and doing everything we need to completely disengage from dialogue and negotiations? And if that is the case, who do we dialogue with at the present situation when your opponent is essentially espousing destruction of your existence? So, I mean, I'm trying to understand, you know, I'm personally for negotiations and dialogue. But I don't know where you find it here.
Right, right. Well,
so I need help.
Yeah. Well, we all do. I mean, in a way, that's my point, is that we don't have a partner for dialogue right now, and yet I'm questioning whether we have done enough to try and encourage that partner to come into being, and that's why I describe what we've done and what we're doing right now is premature. In a sense, we've, I think, given up too quickly on the possibility of negotiations.
Where do you see where we have? I mean, is there can you give a specific situation where you feel that we've given up too easy? Where was there a door in which we were able to open up and participate in some kind of dialogue that would be helpful?
Right. Well, I don't think there has been the door. I mean, I really think that maybe one way into what I'm trying to say is to distinguish between two kinds of negotiation. So on the one hand, there is what we could call genuine good faith negotiation, and that's the dialogical kind. That's the kind where hopefully the interlocutors will at some point reach an accommodation and bring their conflict to a close that way. The other kind is what you might call realpolitik negotiation. And it's the kind of negotiation that people engage in, not because there's any sense in which they're there in good faith, by which I mean that they think that to some degree at least they have to respect or tolerate the other side. And even though they don't like them, that respect calls on them to make some concessions. And concessions not just because they feel forced to do so, but because of that need to tolerate.
Do you think both sides at Oslo felt forced to negotiate, or do you think they really came there of their own volition? In other words, they felt not pressured. Would you consider that a possibility of?
There is even some force in good faith negotiation, right? It's not what I call conversation, which I'm going to argue is a very different form of dialogue in which force, power is not supposed to play a role. Because in negotiations, you are, after all, putting pressure on your adversary to try and get them to make concessions. But the important difference between this good faith negotiation and the realpolitik kind is that when you're negotiating good faith, it's because, again, you're tolerating the other. And that means that if it turns out that the situation changes tomorrow and you might be able to get more of what you want by turning to a more explicit, overt use of force, the good faith negotiator won't do that. The realpolitik negotiator, on the other hand, will, because from the get-go, the realpolitik negotiator isn't there for reasons of toleration. They're there simply because, at the time, they don't have a big enough weapon to get what they want, and so they're turning to this other form of talk. So, given this rather admittedly abstract distinction, I think that it's important to help us get a grasp of the situation today is that, as I see it, for example, Oslo saw two partners. One was attempting to negotiate in good faith. Prime Minister Barak was leading the Israeli side and doing that. The other was negotiating according to the terms of realpolitik. The problem was that, at least from the Israeli side, Israelis weren't really clear on this distinction, which I think is so important, between these two kinds of negotiation. And in fact, it's this failure to be clear on just this distinction which I think made it inevitable that those particular negotiations would have broke down.
Can you explain that a little further, a little more detail?
Well,
where you come up with that conclusion?
Well, simply, if you are negotiating with somebody in good faith and they're not, you're not going to achieve a genuine accommodation at the end. And that's what Barak found. And it says to me that at that moment in time, the situation didn't call for good faith negotiations, basically because the Palestinians didn't have and still don't have that basic minimal level of respect, sense that the Jewish side, the Jewish-Israeli side, has a degree of legitimacy on its part, and so they deserve to be negotiated with in good faith. So that's what's, to me, the key. That's what's missing. We can't have good faith negotiations as a means of responding to the conflict unless both sides recognize to some minimal degree the legitimacy of the other.
Do you think negotiations in the Middle East takes a different form and shape compared to negotiations, say, between Western nations? Yet here you have, and my point is, here you have Israel, basically a Western nation of sorts, and Palestinians coming from that cultural understanding of how to negotiate or move within the confines of dialogue and compromise, maybe running on parallel tracks,
but not meeting. Right?
Exactly, thinking each other. Let's give Arafat the benefit of doubt at this moment, thinking that in fact they are on the same track. I mean, is this a possibility here?
Sure. Yeah. There's no lack of misunderstanding on both sides. I'm not so sure that it's totally accurate to characterize the Palestinian side as utterly foreign in the sense of not part of Western. But
certainly not foreign, because they live among. They live in Israel, and Israel lives in the Middle East, and
Right, but my point has more to do with the old, it's now old, I guess, the clash of civilization thesis that political scientists like Samuel Huntington have been advancing, which is just something that I've never really bought into. One of the reasons being that I don't see Arab or Muslim culture as so non-Western. The walls between the extensive walls between these two worlds are I think very porous and have been historically, and so I think it's a big mistake to simply separate these two civilizations and then say, well, one's West and one's East, when obviously the Arab Muslim culture have had incredible formative influences on the modern West, and I think as well vice versa. So it's just that distinction. I think the reality is a little more complex. But I think you're very right to point out that there's a great deal of misunderstanding and miscommunication on both sides, and that's in a sense what I'm trying to put my finger on here is that in a sense because the Israeli side hasn't been sensitive enough to this distinction between these two kinds of negotiation. They haven't been particularly aware of what the other side has been doing. And again, this is one of the reasons why these particular negotiations broke down. So the upshot of what I'm saying is, all right, if for those who think that the way to deal with this problem is through good faith negotiation, the question is, what should those of us on the Israeli side be doing? And my answer is, well, how can we get them to think about us differently, i.e., if a precondition for good faith negotiation is that you recognize the legitimacy of the other side, not just to exist, right? The text of the Oslo Agreement says, yeah, both sides have a right to exist.
Right.
But what I'm talking about is the legitimacy of Israel as a Jewish state, right? In a sense, that's the heart of Zionism.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the idea is not to convert Palestinians into Zionists, it is only to get them to recognize that Zionism, like their own nationalism, are legitimate national movements. And when there's a conflict, as there is in this case, between two national movements over the same piece of land, well then, what should you do? You should negotiate in good faith.
IsraelSin.com